Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. So, a very busy programme ahead of us here on Mooney Goes Wild, as we do have every Monday night when we bring you into the world of natural history. My panel this evening are two of Ireland's greatest living naturalists, nay, the world's greatest living naturalists. I can go further, the universe's greatest living naturalists. They are still alive, I believe, Aine Ní Leabhna and Richard Collins. Apart from being naturalists, they're also broadcasters and columnists. Richard writes a weekly column every Monday for the Irish Examiner, and Aine has now taken up a new position with the Irish Times. Hello, Aine, tell us more.
Oh, yes, the Eye on Nature column that was written by Etna Viney for over 20 years now. She has retired eventually, hung up her pen, and she did a great job all this length of time, so I am to be doing it instead. So I've had a few goes at it now, and it's great.
In your column at the weekend, Aine, you had a very interesting question about an orchid which was discovered by one of the readers in Sandymount in her garden.
Oh, yes, that's right. Somebody wrote in to say, you know, that they had stopped mowing their lawn and that an orchid had grown in their garden in Sandymount. And were orchids common in Dublin gardens? So what I said was, who knows whether they are or they're not, because most people have their Dublin lawn gardens butchered to bits. They chop the heads of all the plants, they add fertilisers, they remove weeds, they, you know, add in weed killers, fertilisers, all of these kind of things, which any self-respecting biodiversity would run a mile. It's only for growing grass. So we don't really know what the biodiversity might be unless people stop mowing their lawns, because the seed banks in soils for plants and flowers can last up to 80 years, and something that maybe grew there maybe up to 80 years ago might suddenly appear if you stop managing and cutting and mowing and fertilising. So this is what I was more or less getting in the point, that if we want to have this sort of things in our gardens, we should manage them in a much less managed way, let them go wild, stop mowing and let them grow instead. So that was the point of the exercise there. But I mean, there may well be lots of orchids in Dublin's gardens, who knows?
You mean just lying dormant?
Yeah, the seeds will be in the soil. I mean, we all have seen this over the years, that when they put up a new motorway, there's loads of poppies that suddenly grow, and then they grow for 2 or 3 years, and then they're overwhelmed then by the succession of other plants. But the poppy seeds are still there in the soil and will not grow again until the ground is cut and open. So similarly in gardens in urban areas, if you don't manage them by cutting the heads of everything once it appears because you want your grass to grow, then things may be able to send up leaves and be able to become established because their seeds were there all the time. So this seed bank of plants is very, very important, and it's the management of how we do it that stops them from appearing.
Yes, the pyramidal orchid, Anna, seems to be very plentiful this year, out where I am. Of course, it loves sandy grasslands, lime-rich soils, that sort of thing. But I must say, there seems to be more of them than usual. Is this the case, do you think?
It seems to be the case that people are seeing them more. Maybe this is because people are more out and about. Maybe people are beginning to notice flowers more than they did. And certainly, orchids are ones that everybody feels a thrill if they see an orchid. Nobody's going to write a letter saying, I found a daisy or I found a dandelion. But if they see an orchid, now that is the first-class honours one. And then, of course, as well, too, then with them heat and dryness, they will grow and flower. And we didn't have maybe bad springs, bad summers like other years, which just at the wrong time would prevent them from flowering. I have seen plenty of them myself, I have to say. But I have noticed in where I am down here in Clare that there are more or less, because I'm not familiar with being here other years to know what the density was. You'd be more familiar because you're a man that probably always notices the flowers. So if you said there are more there because the weather and the conditions are better for them, I would agree with you then that you know what you're talking about, and there probably are more where you are.
Well, I would never claim to know what I'm talking about, Anna. Error is omnipresent in my discourse. But any one thing I want to mention with you, I would not envy your position, particularly with orchids. You are a kind of consultant who pronounces on photographs people send into the Irish Times. Now, I am told that orchids very often hybridise, so you get descendant of different species showing up. Is that a special difficulty you face?
Well, I don't know, because, I mean, when I'm doing this for the Irish Times, I am not a specialist, I am a generalist. And I mean, because I don't just get questions about plants or just questions about orchids. It's the whole gamut, right from fungi all the way to birds, all the way to lizards, all kinds of things come in. So, I mean, to specifically know which subspecies of an orchid something is, well, you'd probably, if you were the person that wanted to know that amount of information, you might be able to take it further, or I could recommend to them off paper that this is something that you might want to pursue with an expert. But, I mean, the column in the Irish Times is a general column for everybody. What is this strange thing that I found, and what's its name, and tell me more about it. So it's, you know, it's an opportunity to do this. It's a very small amount of space that you can give to each question. So it's just a matter of piquing someone's interest, because, as you know very well, what people do a lot of the times is they Google something. I saw a strange bird, I Googled it, and this bird is only found in Patagonia. How did it end up in my back garden? Because, you know, when they look at things in Google, it's no way of finding out about anything, because the whole world stuff is on that. So it's a way to get away from that, tell somebody what it is that they have found, and then they can pursue and find out more things about it after that. And indeed, you know, 5 or 6 questions every week in the Irish Times is a very small selection of what are sent in fact.
Indeed, and we get a lot of questions in here to Mooney Goes Wild, and we have done over the past 25 years, and you continue to send your questions to mooney@rte.ie, and we welcome them. And you can read Aina in the Irish Times on Saturdays, and here every Monday night on RT Radio 1. Now, I mentioned that Richard writes a weekly column and has done for, oh my God, 15 years or more for the Irish Examiner. And recently, Richard, you had an interesting article about ageing, and you said, according to the Journal of Feline Medicine, I thought, where is he going with this? He's writing about cats. Domestic cats are living longer than they did in the past. 15 years was their expected lifespan, but nowadays many survive well into their 20s. And then you went on to say their owners are living longer too. Tell us more.
I read an awful lot of papers and things. I comb through them looking for interesting things to write about. I'm at that not just for 15, but for 18 years, Derek. And there are now over 1,000 columns written. It's an awful thought, all that work. But anyway, it's about a thing called the invariant rate of aging. Now, it's a doctrine in zoology, which says that the rate of aging of a species is fixed. Everything ages at its own particular rate, and you can't change it. So this is a piece of research that tried to verify or falsify, as the case may be, that idea. So emanated from the University of Southern Denmark. Now, the writer, he investigated 9 human populations. These were populations of people unaffected, largely unaffected by modern technology and the great advantages we enjoy nowadays from science and so forth. He also looked at 17 primate species, the great apes, the monkeys, the lesser apes, and 13 groups in zoos to determine the age of their aging. He did his very best to work this out. And he found that no group of people aged more quickly than any other. Now, okay, you will say, oh, that can't be true. Our life expectancy is, what, 80-something, now 82 on average in the West, whereas in parts of Africa it is so down around 50 and that sort of thing. But yes, that is true. But the maximum lifespan, the average life expectancy is the average age at which people die. But the maximum lifespan is the longest one can go on before dying. Jan Calmer, I think her name is, reached the age of 122 in France a few years ago. That is the known record for the longest lived person. Now, he found that the maximum lifespan is more or less fixed. Now, what happens, of course, with societies which have a low life expectancy is that they're young, the youngsters, the babies die a lot, and the young people are disadvantaged and they get into trouble and they have accidents and diseases and so on. Now, in the West, where things are very affluent, we have eliminated that. And so our babies survive and our young people survive. So what's actually happening is not that we are living longer. We're living longer on average. We are not increasing our maximum life expectancy. What we're doing is we're shifting the deaths from the beginning of life towards the end of life. Now, in a nutshell, The invariant rate of aging is verified by this fellow. He claims, yes, we have a fixed rate of aging. We can't do anything about it. But I'm reminded of Epicurus, who said, do not spoil what you have by desiring what you have not.
Wise words indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Richard. Now, how many flowers can you name? Aina and Richard were just talking about orchids popping up in the garden, and Aina is saying that people would probably recognise an orchid because it's one of the unusual ones. Research shows that the average Irish person can name between just 3 and 6 common wildflowers, but can identify a lot more common mammals or birds. This tendency of people to view plants as background or to not notice them or correctly identify them is called plant blindness. Never heard of it before. This is problematic from a conservation perspective because people are less inclined to care about protecting things that they don't know about. So says Dr. Karen L. Bacon, lecturer in plant ecology at NUI Galway. She's based in Loughrea, from where she joins us now. Hello, Karen. Thank you for joining us today. Tell us more about your research, please.
Hi, Derek, Aina and Richard. So my research is focused on plant ecology generally, and I'm interested in how plants respond to their environments. But I'm also interested in how people engage with plants and in looking at a phenomenon that is called plant blindness. And this is the lack of engagement or awareness that people have with plants in comparison to animals.
And what is it about plants that people just don't see them?
So it's, in a sense, it's that people just view plants as background. So they're kind of just there in the background. And for example, if we show people photographs of an animal, that the animal is blurry or not really the focus of the picture, but you can see the details of the plant really clearly, they'll struggle to look at the picture and they say, well, I think it might be a dragonfly or it might be a bumblebee. And when you're saying, well, actually, it's showing you a blackberry bush with a very out of focus bumblebee in it. It's that people view plants as the background, even when they're maybe the focus of what you're looking at. And it's a phenomenon that has been identified for quite a long time, since the 90s was when the term was first coined by American researchers. And it's a form of cognitive bias where people just don't immediately engage with the plants. They don't really see them and they consign them to the background. And that's something that we're trying to investigate and trying to find ways of making people maybe a little bit more plant aware, more engaged with plants.
I was interested in your research, that the initial part of it where it said, you know, people can only recognise and name 3 or 4 plants. I find that very difficult to believe. I mean, when I visit schools, as I did before we was all stopped with COVID, even the baby infants could tell me daisies, dandelions and buttercups. They could tell me 3 flowers coming to school. So I think what you're going on to spell out is more important than whether people know the names of the flowers or not. The fact that they don't see them as the important thing, that they see the things that move, they see the animals as the important thing in the environment rather than the background in which they are. In fact, at one point in the Tree Council, we came across a member of the public who didn't realise that trees were different. He thought all trees were the same, just big ones and small ones, that the leaves of the oak were different to the leaves of the ash, or that there were such things, wasn't known to them at all. So it's probably because of a lack of understanding of the importance of plants in how the biodiversity of the world works. Because with our food chains, with our food webs, everything begins with the plants. And the plants, of course, are the things that fix the carbon as food, as carbohydrates in the plants, and on which all our animals will depend upon. But the animals are more sexy. They move, they've got colours, they do things, and people tend to think, well, they're very exciting. Now, speaking as a botanist, I really can't understand this at all. It's so much easier and more exciting to look at flowers and plants because they're there. They don't run away. You haven't got to be focusing on them in the distance, and you can see the wonderful colours and beauty of them. But so it's really a matter of how all this thing is sold to the public, the importance of the different components of our environment. And I think that's beginning to change now as people are getting out and about more in their local areas.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think one of the things that we found actually was that school children are quite good And there's lots of, I think there's been a lot of effort in particularly primary school to try and bring a little bit more plant stuff back in, things like forest schools and stuff like that, becoming a bit more popular. And certainly the small bit of research that we did with some school children, the kids are quite good, but it seems to disappear then as people get older. And in part probably because it doesn't follow through. There isn't as much taught about botany when you go into kind of later years of education. And what is taught maybe is plant reproductive cycles or photosynthesis, which are obviously really, really important. But it's perhaps not always the most engaging way, as you've said there, about the, you know, interactions with animals, food webs, and then just the beauty of the plants, the colours, the, you know, really kind of getting into looking at plants is not something that a tremendous amount of a time is spent on in education. And I also think that what you've said about people kind of maybe getting a bit more back into it is really, really true. I think we saw that really well during the lockdowns, where people suddenly had, unfortunately, had more time to engage with nature. And the National Biodiversity Database has a huge peak in records being submitted when people were going out and trying to identify plants and animals. And I agree completely that it's about how it is presented to the public, because plants are absolutely critical. They are the foundation of life on land. When we think about the various different global challenges that we're facing, food security, water quality, climate change, all of this is plants are crucial to trying to understand and tackle these issues. And I think that that is also part of the problem, because plants are so often kind of pushed to the background when people are thinking about, you know, just not just conservation or ecology, but all of these other big problems as well. And plants are not always as included as part of the solution for trying to deal with these things as they probably need to be.
We were referring there earlier in the programme to the amazement of people when they stop mowing their lawns as to the flowers that will suddenly appear, that people have been brainwashed for a very long time into thinking that wild things are weeds and that they shouldn't be there, and that you should mow your lawn, that you should have it all the one species. And yet we have so much people complaining about the fact that some of our woodlands are monocultures of one species of evergreen tree. I mean, surely there is an awareness being manifest that one species of a single tree at the same age, which some of our plantations of forests are not desirable from a point of view of biodiversity. And there is more and more demand and welcome towards forests now being planted from many different varieties of deciduous trees, and then the understory associated with that. People are beginning to see that this is a better thing than a monoculture, which what a Sitka spruce forest is an actual crop. You're comparing something the same as a field of barley in the sense it's grown for a crop. And people are beginning to differentiate between a crop of one particular species and a whole lovely forest of different trees, different ages, different understories. And that is what is needed in order for us to have the animals present. I think the connection is beginning to come back, that if we don't have the variety of plants and plant species, we're not going to have the variety of animals that they seem to care about even more. They're beginning to understand that we won't have the animals if we don't have the plants. So maybe you're pushing an open door in this research as a consequence of that.
Yeah, and I think that's true as well. And I think there has, I do think you're quite right that there has been a change in recent years. And I think that people are kind of more open to it. It's great to see, you know, the council's not mowing in May, and letting our native wildflowers come up and go through their life cycles. It would be nice to see that extended a little bit more as well, just past May. And I agree as well, it's great to see the mix of more deciduous trees being planted and managed. There is definitely an increased awareness on what there was a number of years ago. However, I think there is still a significant disparity between what people recognise and value in terms of kind of plants versus animals. I do think it is a bit of an open door. I think that, and that's really good because it shows that people are interested and that there's the potential for engagement there as well. It's almost like the plants 9 times out of 10 are being viewed as of benefit because they provide some sort of additional service. So because they provide habitat for animals or because they provide a food source for animals, it's not necessary. It's still putting them in a background. It's not viewing them as valuable in and of themselves, that the plants have a value themselves. They're obviously, everything is connected, but they're not just there as a service provider to animals. But you know, that is also incredibly important. So I do think you're right there. It is definitely better than it was a number of years ago, but I think there's quite a lot of room for growth, for people to maybe view the benefits and the value of plants by themselves, not just as how they provide services to other things.
You haven't quite completed your research, but what's the final plan? What will you do when you have?
Well, the research is still at a relatively early stage, so what we want to do is extend it considerably, and we want to try and extend it out to survey many more people, and to then try to think about the next step beyond that is to try and think about how to engage with different groups and try and encourage people to engage a little bit more with particularly our native flora. Because quite a lot of people as well will have beautiful gardens, but won't really be that engaged with our native plants. And that's something that we want to think about trying to address in the next stage of the research.
Karen, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
All right, time now to check in with Terry Flanagan, our man who keeps his eye on nature. And he's in County Limerick today at the Bat Hospital, aren't you, Terry?
Indeed I am, Derek. I'm down in Brewery in County Limerick and I'm at the Bat Hospital. And we've covered bats quite a lot on the programme over the last number of years. In fact, I remember, I can't remember how long ago, but you were down in, was it County Clare, with a woman who had a half door and the top half was open and the bats used to fly in and out of the house.
True, Terence, and indeed not a bother on her. I would have been more put out if a bat came into the house than this woman was, but then she was well used to it, living in the countryside.
Well, where I am today, the bats aren't flying in and out of the house, but they are a very misunderstood species, and there's terrible myths about them. One, that they fly into women's hairs. That's not true at all. And they're often referred to as mice with wings. Not at all. Couldn't be further from the truth. And that they suck blood. No, they don't suck blood. There's over 1,000 species of bats on Earth. And of those 1,000 species, only 3 of them actually suck blood, and none of them are in Ireland. In fact, in Ireland, we have 9 species of bats, and they're all insectivorous. And they're fantastic animals because they eat all of these midges and that. And a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about fish's eyes, or should I say fish eyes. You remember that one, Derek?
How could I forget?
Well, I'll be talking about bats' eyes now in a moment, because bats are not blind. That's another misconception, as blind as a bat. Bats can see. And in fact, if we go back to the late 1700s, I think 1793, an Italian scientist, a guy called Spallanzani, he had a pet owl and he used to take this owl out at night and fly him. And then he tried flying him in the house one night with all of the lights turned off, complete darkness, and the owl kept crashing into the walls. So it made him think about it. He decided to do some experiments on the eyes of owls, and then he carried it on the eyes of bats. So he went out and he captured these bats and he took them indoors, dark room. In the room, he placed very, very thin wires across the room and they were zigzagging across the room and they had these bells hanging from them. And he let the bats fly out in the room. And of course, they'd no problem at all zigzagging through the wires. He then decided on an experiment. He decided, I'm going to take out the bat's eyes. So he removed the bat's eyes. You wouldn't get away with it nowadays in college or in university doing an experiment like that. But anyway, he did it. Let the bats go, minus their eyes. Again, no problem flying through the room. So he published his results. And the following year, another scientist called Durin, he decided to follow up on this. So he had this idea that the bats saw with their ears. So he decided to plug the ears of the bats with wax, did the very same experiment, released them into the room, and of course the bats flew into every wall and every wire, bells were ringing all over the place. So the conclusion was that bats emit this ultrasound or high frequency sound, and they analyse the echo that's produced. We refer to it as echolocation. Well, I'm here today, I'm in the bat hospital. I'm not actually inside the hospital, I'm outside, and I'm in the bat flight, and I'm joined by Susan Kerwin, who's the founder of the bat hospital.
Hi Terry, how are you?
Good.
Welcome back.
How are you keeping?
Great, great, very busy. So we're here in the bat flight tonight, and we have six juvenile Leisler pups.
Yes, what I should say the bat flight is it's an outdoor enclosure, a very, very fine mesh. It's probably about 10 metres by 10 metres or so, and there are bats flying around us.
Yes, so this is where we take the bats down to assess their flight capability before they're released. It's very important for the pups, as you can see, because they're quite clumsy, so they're not consistent with their flight. As you mentioned, bats use echolocation, and this helps them to map out their environment. So they can tell if something is static that they don't want to crash into, or if it's an insect that's moving and that's something that they can prey on. So
now, I'm just watching a couple of them flying around there behind you, and they're flying and just landing on the mesh and looking out, so to speak.
That's it. So they're listening to all the sounds that are out there. At this hour of the evening, we'll have Leislers out there that are in the wild already, and they will hear the juveniles calling, so they'll be curious enough, the adults, to come in and see what's happening here as well. So there's lots of communication between the pups and the wild population.
Because it's not quite dark yet. We always think of bats being out at night time, but it's still very much twilight here. The birds, we can still hear them. And the bats would normally come out this little bit early, would they?
Yes, Leislers is a species that would emerge first in the evening, so just around this time. And it's sometimes people will actually confuse Leislers for swallows and swifts because they're still out during the night. But they are quite a large bat, and you will see them in open spaces diving down to feed on beetles and other insects.
Okay, we were here last year, the year before, I can't remember exactly when, but it was the week that you had opened. And since then, I can see you've had a lot of extensions.
Yes, we did. Because the number of bats coming in needing help has risen so dramatically, we had to go and build another bat flight. So this is the one we're in at the moment. It's twice as large as the other. So now this is what we will be using for Leislers. As I mentioned, they're a larger bat and they just need that bit more room for their twisting and turning and learning those skills.
I'm just watching these ones, as I said here. They're very agile, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, they're very agile. And you can see with the twists and turns. But this is what they're going to need in the wild to hone in these skills before they're going to be capable of surviving and being able to forage for themselves.
How long do you leave them out for then in the evenings?
So we leave them out the first couple of evenings. We'll take them out, we'll bring them in after a couple of hours, let them adjust to what they're doing. We can bring them back in, weigh them and see if we need to supplement their diet with extra insects. In the coming week, we're going to be placing them in bat boxes and they're going to stay out here. So as you can see in here, it's full of insect life.
Yeah.
And that's because where it's placed. So it's placed along the ditches that would have that natural buzzing of insects. So hoping that they'll be able to learn how to forage and provide food for themselves before being released.
Now, you were telling me earlier on that you're getting lots and lots of calls from people who are finding bats, more so than ever before, and they want to know what to do with them. Is there a problem out there?
So we are getting a lot of calls, and that's because people are finding numbers of dead bats at this time of the year, or what look to be sick and weak bats. And this is a natural process that happens every year. And unfortunately, there's a very high mortality rate in juveniles as they learn to venture outside of the roost. Unfortunately, there is quite a high mortality rate during these months, the summer months, when the breeding season is in full swing. So what you're finding are bat pups that have, their curiosity has taken them out of the roost, they've crawled out and they haven't been able to make it back. So they're showing up on the ground outside people's homes. And then with the weather as well, if it's been a particularly rainy night, a lot of them will perish. So that's where their mortalities are coming from. Naturally, bats will go into a semi type of torpor during the day. So what you perceive as being weak or sickly is actually just their natural behaviour during the day, as they are a nocturnal species. So lots of calls coming in concerned, do people need to be worried? And especially in this time of the COVID and COVID pandemic, people, when they find high mortality in any species of animal, will be concerned. But just to reassure people that this is completely normal. And if they have any concerns, please contact me or else contact one of their national parks and wildlife rangers, and they'll be able to discuss it with them as well.
Just looking at the ones here in this flight, they're doing really, really well. When will they be gone?
By the way that they're flying at the moment, it'll be another week, and we'll hope to get them back. So these have come from Meath. The six of them were found together, so they'll all be sent back to Meath together to be released with their colony.
So they're brothers and sisters, so to speak.
They are. They're brothers and sisters. So they'll all go back. It's very important, when possible, that we need to get them back. Bats are social creatures, so they have their own little family dynamic. So getting them back with their family is very important, especially for females. Females will stay together over their entire life, so the colony will just continue to grow, bringing their own pups with their mothers back again every year.
Do you ever tag the bats before you let them go? In other words, to try and learn something about them?
That's something that we're in the process of doing at the moment. This all has to be done under licence. So what we want to do for the future is to be able to tag these bats, that somebody may come across them and we will be able to study their survival rate and to see their migratory paths as well and where they go between roosts. So we're trying to get more involved with ecological studies and to support any studies that are ongoing at the moment. Some of the bats that come in unfortunately don't make it, and those bats then we use to send out to ecologists that train their dogs to find these dead bats in the field.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
It's amazing, and it's great to be able to support this kind of training.
And the dogs, they can pick up on this, can they?
The dogs are trained to find dead bats in the field, and this will go towards studies that are being run for environmental impact on bats in the wild.
What do the locals think when they see you taking in bats? Do they think you're a bit mad?
They might, but I know that I've received great support. Everyone is buzzing about the fact that we have the hospital here in Limerick. And I think that it's something that people want to get more involved in. I get messages from people all the time wanting to get more involved in bat rehab. We have a large volunteer basis now built up all over the country. And we're also doing online training courses for people that want to learn how to transport bats safely. And I think that by opening the bat hospital, that we have catapulted bats into the front of people's minds, and we want to keep them there.
Into the limelight, you could say.
Into the limelight.
At night.
At night.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. More details on the website, as always, rte.ie/Mooney. Let's say hello now to our fisheries scientist, Mr. Ken Whelan, who joins us from his home in Rathgar. Hello, Ken. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you, Derek. Great to be on with you again.
Lovely to speak with you now. And Richard is still there. Aina has said goodbye to us. Richard and Ken, I was watching a documentary about sharks the other night, and I'm very interested to learn more about what's called land sharks. Have you ever heard of land sharks? These are sharks that are getting more brazen, coming out of the water in order to get at food. And there was a particular example shown, a video of a whale carcass which had washed up on a beach. Now, it was just at the water's edge, and this great big tiger shark came up and actually came out of the water to grab a bit of the meat and was gnawing away at it, and then managed to get itself back into the water. But it came out of the water. And then they showed bull sharks in the Bahamas. These researchers were putting down fish on steps, you know, just on a pier that you'd step down the steps and get into a boat, or eventually end up in the water if you kept going down all the steps. Well, they went down to the water's edge and put little bits of bait on this step, and the bull sharks came out to take it. And they said this is evidence of sharks learning to walk. And they've given them the term land sharks. Have you ever heard the like, Ken?
I haven't heard of them called land sharks. I've heard them called epaulette sharks. And the reason being that their little fins, the pectoral fins at their shoulders and the pelvic fins that would be at their legs if they had legs, they've been modified so that they can live both on rocks and in various sea pools. And that was the first time I'd seen the term land sharks. But certainly that particular article is fascinating in terms of the speed at which they're evolving.
Are they evolving? Is this something new? After all, go back 300 million years and fish began to crawl out and develop legs, go to Valencia, the tetrapod footprints. This is there a long time. The sharks seem rather slow off the mark. Perhaps they're doing this much longer than we thought. They might have done it to get from one pool to another or something like that, or in seashore and stuff like that. Do we know that it's very recent, or is it just that we've noticed it recently?
I think that's a very good question, Richard. I'm not sure we're going to be able to get to the answer to that particular one today. I think it's probably a mixture of both. But the great thing about sharks and rays is that, as you say, they've been around for a long, long time. They're the original of the species as such, probably about 400 million years ago. These creatures with sharp teeth and so on started to appear in our oceans. But classically, you would always regard sharks and rays as fish that were very slow in terms of evolving, because you can find maybe 100 million years ago, you can find the same dentition in some of the fossils we have, the same dentition as we have today in some of our modern sharks. So it was always assumed that these were going to be fairly slow in terms of evolving. And therefore, people were really concerned that with global climate change and so on, that these sharks could, in fact, suffer as a result of that. So this new research, what it's saying is that, well, at least in this particular group of fish, they think they have actually begun to trace really quite fast evolution. And they're now seeing a lot more species of these sharks than they would have thought heretofore. And I must say, it's quite convincing just reading the reports that in this particular line, at least, they seem to be a lot more plastic. But you have to think about where they're living. So they're living on coral reefs, and any animal or plant that takes up residence on a coral reef for millions of years, they have to be very adaptable to survive, because it's not just our current climate change impacts that these particular structures have suffered. They've suffered long, long before that as well. But I think it's a fair point as to whether we're just discovering it now or whether it's something that's inherent. But I wouldn't think it's inherent in all the different races of sharks.
Does it reflect on you, Lot? There were four species of leopard shark discovered since 2008. Now, it's extraordinary that creatures so big, so likely to be caught by fishermen all over the world, or, well, not in this case, locally, that they should go unnoticed. Isn't it very strange?
It is strange, but at the same time, there still, I mean, a lot of the ocean is largely undiscovered. We've talked before on the programme about the deeps, but never mind the deeps. There are quite a lot of isolated coastlines around the world where no biological surveys have taken place. But certainly it is interesting that they would claim that these new species have been found in such a short space of time. It may very well be that they are now concentrating on these particular creatures because they have a particular interest in them as climate change indicators, and therefore they're finding out more. I mean, for example, I think it was last year, was it, that some of the scientists in UCD discovered a new mayfly. And that mayfly has been around for a long time, and we failed to notice it in an environment where we think we're doing an awful lot more in terms of monitoring, and still we missed that particular one. So maybe it's not that surprising.
Are you hopeful for the future of sharks?
I think I am. I'm sure on Sunday morning that you were reading the Sunday Morning Herald from Sydney. That had a very interesting comment to make, and it's to do with the conservation of sharks. And they're claiming now that really we should not mention shark attacks ever again. And they have renamed them. So they're saying now that if we're dealing with sharks, we should talk about negative encounters that might result in bites. So that's their substitute for shark attacks. And they're also saying that the reason they're doing this is to dispel the inherent assumptions that sharks are ravenous, mindless, man-eating monsters. And if we're going to stop the massive culls of sharks that are taking place across the ocean for shark fins and everything else, and if we're to stop the global decline in sharks, we really shouldn't talk about shark attacks. So I think if you get attacked on Dollymount Strand some evening when you're out for a swim, you can remember that you weren't attacked as such. You just had a negative encounter that unfortunately resulted in a bite.
Oh, indeed. So you'd like to ban Jaws. Steven Spielberg should be trounced for this dreadful disservice he did to sharks. Would you agree?
I think in reality, I am just a fan. They are wonderful creatures. And interestingly, we just missed it with the programme because on the 14th of July was National Shark Day. And we must remember that we're very lucky in Ireland. Out of the, well, I think it's about 1,200 or something sharks that are present around the world, we have 71 sharks and rays in Ireland, and we get lots of interesting visitors. And a little like the epaulette sharks, I think as our surveys go on and as the water gets a bit warmer, we may actually see other visitors to our shores. But we have some really important populations of shark. For example, the blue shark. We get a very large proportion of juvenile blue sharks actually feeding off our coast during the summer months. So we have big concentrations of blues normally. And then in addition to that, we have the really big ocean hunters as well. We have the poor beagle sharks and we have some makos as well. In addition, of course, to the giant basking sharks, which have appeared again now with the fine weather. And I see reports rolling in this morning of people enjoying watching these wonderful creatures off the west coast. So we're really fortunate in terms of the sharks and rays that we have around Ireland.
Well, speaking of warm waters and fish, because that's what sharks are, they're fish, they're not mammals. The next question is, why are some fish warm-blooded when most are not? Well, it gives some predatory sharks a crucial speed advantage. However, unlike what was previously thought, they do not live in broader temperature ranges. So, warm-blooded fish are just as vulnerable to rising ocean temperatures as their cold-blooded relatives. These are some of the conclusions of new research from marine biologists. Lucy Harding is a PhD candidate at the Department of Zoology in Trinity College Dublin. She's on the road to County Cork as we speak. She's pulled over, needless to say, to speak with us, and she can tell us all about this research. Hello, Lucy. Where exactly are you? What are you going to do in Cork today?
Hi, Derek. So at the moment, I'm actually en route to Court McSherry down in Cork, joining the rest of my lab down there. We're conducting some more shark tagging today, and this is part of a PhD in Trinity College.
So what kind of sharks will you be hoping to tag today?
So today we are looking specifically for blue sharks and poor beagle sharks. And I really want to find some poor beagle sharks myself because they are these warm-blooded fishes that I talk about in my recent study. And I'm hoping that I might be able to get some body temperature from them to see kind of how they're behaving and what they're doing in the water.
Hi, Lucy. I'm absolutely delighted that you're taking an interest in poor beagles because I'm so old that I used to work with a group called the Inland Fisheries Trust. And while I was with the Trust, because we were mainly involved with sport fish, we took a great interest then in the biology of poor beagles. And a colleague of mine, Kevin Lennon, and some of his friends, they began to actually then fish for poor beagles, particularly off the cliffs in County Clare. And they were very successful. And they produced a wonderful film called Porgy in Blue, which you really must get a copy of, that actually involved, though it was with angling, it does talk a bit about the behaviour of them in Irish waters. So your research then is looking at why this warm-blooded feature within the poor beagles, why it's an advantage to these particular creatures.
Yeah, so my recent study that's just been published is looking at trying to understand why a small number of fish and sharks have evolved this ability. So there's only about 35 species of these warm-blooded fishes, and generally they are predatory, high-level sharks and fish. And this is only about 0.1% of all the fishes that have been described so far. So I was really interested to try and understand why would they evolve this ability. And this has been known about for at least 50 years now. And there's been lots of ideas kind of put forward as to why they might have invested in putting this ability into their bodies. And so two main ideas that have persisted the whole way along. The first idea was that these warm-blooded animals are warming their muscles up and making them more powerful. And that will allow them to swim faster than the cold-blooded fish and sharks around them. And then another idea that persisted alongside this was that it is allowing these animals to live in a broader range of temperatures. And therefore, this will allow them to swim in more areas, to hunt and to migrate. And this was assumed then to allow them to be more resilient to things like climate change and ocean warming. And so what we decided to do was to go out and actually directly test both of these persisting ideas and try and figure out which one was the reason that these animals have evolved this ability.
How do you test that?
So the way that we went about testing this was quite a new approach in that we decided to look at individual fish and sharks. So by that, I mean that we were attaching devices to individual animals that we caught off our boats. And so this involved a huge team effort. We have collaborators from all over the world who are helping us collect this data. And alongside our own individual efforts, we also collected data from published papers that have been out for years and perhaps just hadn't looked at this specific idea. So the data was out there and it hadn't been used yet. So what we did was we collected all of this published data, and then we also collected our own data from animals that we had tagged. And we decided to look at things like the temperature that these animals were swimming in, the depths that they were swimming in, and also the speed at which each animal was swimming. And that's specifically kind of their cruising speed. So when they're swimming along, just, you know, enjoying their day, cruising through the water. And then what we were able to do was to work out what speeds these animals were swimming at, what temperature ranges they were living in. And then we were able to test these two ideas beside each other.
In doing that, what you came up with was the conclusion that above anything else, this was advantageous to them in terms of their feeding. And certainly I've been lucky enough to see some of the marlin and some of the sailfish in the Indian Ocean and how quickly they can move when they're zoning in on baitfish. So this is where they get the really big advantage, I gather, from what you've done so far.
So when it comes to things like feeding, you're more kind of thinking about burst speed. So that would be a different mechanism to what we were looking at. That's what we call anaerobic energy. So that's where they've just really quickly changed their speed. What we were looking more specifically at was just their average speed. So when they're cruising around, and this was to look at the general speeds that they swim at, and whether or not this cruising speed was higher or lower than these cold-blooded animals, or whether it was the same. But what we actually found was that these warm-blooded animals, when they're just cruising around the water, they're actually swimming 1.6 times faster than the cold-blooded counterparts. And so this can feed into things like predation, as you mentioned. It can relate to their migration. And it can also allow them advantages in that they can identify their prey quicker, because the faster they're swimming, the faster that image of the prey moves across their eye. And so they can quickly identify it and move in. And so this is the speed advantage that we've identified.
Lucy, how do the energetics match up? If you take land animals, they converted to warm-bloodedness way back. Mammals, for instance, warm-blooded. And presumably there were advantages in terms of being able to move quicker and predate better and so forth. Now, the sea is far more uniform in temperature than is the land. They don't get such great variation. But if we look at the land mammals that are warm-blooded, they have vastly more energy requirements than have slow things like amphibians and reptiles. So the energetics, the budget is different. Now, if you look at the fish, you have streamlined fish in the water, good at catching things at high speed. Presumably the energetics there are going to be unfavorable. They're going to have to pay the bill of being able to do so. Or is that the case?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And so we didn't specifically calculate energetics within our study, but it's definitely something we're interested in and we look at in our lab. And as you say, you know, this warm-blooded adaptation, it is definitely more energetically costly. And interestingly, as you were saying, the shape of the body of these animals, so these warm-blooded animals, they tend to all be these high-level predatory kind of apex species like your white sharks, your Atlantic bluefin tuna, and they're very good hunters. And so definitely we think that there is a relation between the fact that these warm-blooded animals are also these apex predatory species. And it's definitely something that we really want to look into further, trying to calculate the energetics that are involved with maintaining this elevated body temperature.
You mentioned the great white. Now, that animal goes against your thesis in a sense. If you go to South Africa, Dyer Island, for instance, and go down in the cage to look at them, the water is unbelievably cold. You have to wear a wetsuit, and if it doesn't fit well, you'll freeze. Now, yet that animal is found all over the temperate seas of the world, and it's found in the Bay of Biscay, where the waters are much warmer. So here you have a giant fish that is very ubiquitous in the world, and indeed they will possibly show up in Ireland if global warming continues, which seems to go against your thesis.
Yeah, so we have included the white shark in our study as well, because as you say, it is seen in a very broad range of temperatures. And so what we wanted to look at specifically was not the extremes that these animals are going to, the maximum and the minimums. It's the width of that range of temperatures. So it's not specifically, you know, how cold or how hot they're encountering. It's how big is that range between what is the maximum and what is the minimum that they can live in. And actually, when we included the white shark in our study, it did go with our paper. So we did find that even though they have quite a large range of temperature, the range across the warm-blooded and the cold-blooded fishes was actually not significantly different. Even with the inclusion of the white shark, it did agree with our paper.
Sorry, Lucy, just to ask you a little bit, if I may, about the migration component of this. I think it's really interesting in that the two big species that we have here, we were talking about the poor beagle, but also increasingly we have research ongoing on the West Coast with the bluefin tuna. And I did a little bit at the very initial stages on the bluefin tuna. And they have an incredible range in terms of the width of the ocean that they can cover, how quickly they can cover it. And that aligns really with what Richard is asking about in terms of the great white as well. So it may well be that if you have this ability for your motor to keep running, and what actually gives you the advantage is the fact that you're warm-blooded, the motor system that they have to move very long distances, that may actually be the advantage that they have, more than what I was speaking about earlier, which, as you rightly said, was just the sort of immediate response to feeding. So do you think that this ability to migrate trans-ocean across huge areas of the ocean, that this may be linked in then with their ability to regulate their own temperature?
Yep, so that's a really interesting question, Ken. And when we were looking at our data and we had come to this conclusion that, in fact, this is actually allowing these warm-blooded animals to swim 1.6 times faster than the cold-blooded animals, we started to think, well, what would be the advantages of swimming faster than these other animals? And so that's why we started to look at things like migration. So is it allowing them to swim further? Is it allowing them to complete more frequent migrations? And definitely there's follow-on studies that need to be done there, looking into these migratory ranges as well, and kind of the spatial range that these animals are traveling, because we only focus specifically on the thermal, the temperature range, but definitely more studies need to be done on the spatial range of these warm-blooded animals.
I have an alternative perhaps to put to you, something that has puzzled me for quite a long time. I can see now on the wall of my office a picture of a bronze whaler shark that I caught about maybe 15 years ago off the coast of Kenya. And I was just so impressed with the speed and the power of that particular shark. It was absolutely unbelievable. It wasn't a particularly big one. It was about 120, 130 pounds. But I was fascinated by the turn of speed. And the skipper was saying to me that they are particularly well known for their ability to move very fast. And when I looked up their range, they tend to concentrate their migrations into areas where they have really suitable water temperatures. So rather than evolving a mechanism to try and regulate their own temperature, what they do is they concentrate their movements into an area where the seas are warmer, which I presume would also help in terms of making sure that their muscles were able to flex at an increased rate of speed. So to some extent, that may very well support your view that the migration element of the warm-blooded fish, it may very well be that it's the migration component of this that's the key. Because certainly in terms of attack speed, I was so impressed with the ability of what would be a totally cold water fish to move so fast in the ocean.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight, and definitely something that we've been thinking about ourselves, because as we know, a lot of fishes and sharks will have quite broad ranges of temperatures that they can live in, but they definitely have preferred temperatures that they like to live in. And so when we look at cold-blooded versus warm-blooded, as you say, the cold-blooded ones could be moving to these warmer temperatures to maybe try and warm their own bodies up. Because when we talk about warming their bodies and warming their muscle to increase power output, we're specifically talking about the red mussel. And cold-blooded fishes do actually have red mussel sometimes as well. They just may not have the ability to warm it themselves. So yeah, that's definitely something we need to look into more, as to whether these cold-blooded fishes are using their environment to warm up their red mussel and try and get that increased power that the warm-blooded fishes are able to generate themselves.
Well, Lucy, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you very much indeed, and good luck with your research. I don't think I'd like to be out for a swim and bump into a great white shark, Ken Whelan, would you?
Certainly not. But remember, there's no such thing as a shark attack anymore. It's encounters where there's a tendency to bite.
Ken, thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Richard Collins, to Aidan Elana. Our researcher is John Bellarelli, and the broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. We'll do it all again next week. Don't forget, you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/media. Until next week, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.